Welcome to the University of California San Francisco Sports Medicine Podcast featuring Dr. Nirav Pandya, Dr. Brian Feely, and Dr. Drew Lansdown discussing hot topics in sports medicine and society. We hope you enjoy our podcast and look forward to hearing from you.
All right, welcome everyone to the fifth edition of our sports medicine podcast, 6 to 8 weeks, featuring Dr. Brian Feely, Dr. Drew Lansdown, and myself, Dr. Nirav Pandya. Today we're going to be talking about golf, and one of the things that is being promoted now is getting out and playing golf. It's a sport in which you can potentially socially distance. It's a great way to get out and exercise in the outdoors. But although there's been a lot of concentration on MLB, NBA, NFL, the PGA Tour has returned, and there are factors we have to take into consideration when playing golf, both from an injury perspective as well as COVID as well too. And one of the things we're doing at UCSF is covering some of the major golf tournaments, particularly the PGA tournament, which is going to be coming in San Francisco shortly. So my first question is for you, Drew. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, covering golf and some of the considerations that go into being a team physician or medical coverage for an event such as this?
Yeah. So, you know, at UCSF, we're really excited to be working with the PGA. The PGA Championship is going to be at Harding Park the first week of August. And we'll be providing the on-site medical coverage. And we had started talking to them, I think late last year, when you know they were planning for a normal major tournament. And so, you know, the plan was initially anticipating about 40,000 spectators on site for the event, along with the golfers, the media, the volunteers. And you know, it's one of the bigger golf tournaments. There's four majors each year, this being one of them. And so we were initially planning in that direction. And then obviously things changed quite a bit with COVID. So now we're anticipating a, you know, an event without spectators, but still, you know, with 156 golfers, caddies, support staff, media, volunteers. So it should still be a great event. And it's definitely changed our focus though, because initially our coverage were, you know, thinking about how to keep the spectators safe along with everyone else. And then now, you know, a lot of the focus is on appropriate pre-tournament screening, making sure that, you know, practices are safe with regard to COVID especially, and then also providing any, you know, on-site medical coverage that's needed. So a lot of our focus has, it's been different and making sure that we're, you know, able to provide the appropriate care, whether that's, you know, an isolation tent to handle any potential COVID concerns that come up during the time, as well as just the routine injuries or even medical emergencies that might come up during the event. And, you know, it's been really great working with the PGA. They're just a top-notch organization and, you know, all throughout the whole organization when it was a, you know, a larger spectator-driven event versus the newer scaled-back event with much different protocols. They've been just on top of everything and really great to work with. So we're pretty excited about it.
You know, one of the things that we always have to worry about as well too is that even though perhaps the risk of getting COVID, you know, while playing may be low, these are still individuals who are walking around in our society. You know, there was a player, Nick Watney, who was diagnosed with COVID. What were some of the unique ways that it actually was found out besides the test that he may be having some sort of symptoms of this disease?
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. So he was diagnosed with a wearable device that he wears on his wrist that measures his respiratory rate. And I think we see more and more athletes looking for essentially a competitive edge to look for sleep patterns, breathing patterns, ways to track subtle differences in their health. And among other symptoms, one of the things that he noticed was that his respiratory rate overnight, the night before that he was diagnosed, was increased. So that was probably the first marker for that. And I kind of wonder if that's not the wave of the future for athletes to either have wearables or eventually implantables that will try to give them the competitive edge. And I think back to the Olympics where swimmers were wearing essentially shark skin suits to try to give them the hundredths of a second edge. And you know, something that helps you sleep a little bit better or let you know when you can go back to sleep, maybe enough to give you that competitive edge for something like winning the PGA tournament or gaining a little bit extra ability to stay sharp through an entire basketball game or soccer game.
Yeah, it is pretty amazing how much data now, you know, we can get from these wearables. I know the NBA has been utilizing a lot where they can look at muscle activation. They can look at how many steps players are taking and, kind of the old adage was just keep training harder and harder and harder. And I think it's more about training smarter now and taking in all this data. And we as physicians have to catch up and kind of interpret all these things that are out there.
Yeah, we don't really talk about it too much, but the ability to analyze that data almost in real time is huge. And the fact that you can essentially download the information from your wrist to your phone instantaneously was not something even able to be done 5 years ago. And now we essentially take it for granted. And it's really going to be fascinating how people use this in games or in tournaments to help improve their performance.
Yeah, I think the other thing too is just how I think commendable it is for like somebody like Nick Watney, where it's the middle of a tournament. Sounded like he wasn't even feeling symptomatic, but just kind of noticed that just something was off a bit and said, you know, I should get tested. I should be safe. And so I think it's a really great example that, the middle of a big tournament, he's saying, this is important for me to be tested and make sure that, you know, I'm helping to keep everybody else safe out there.
Yeah, so let's switch gears for a little bit and talk about golf in general. You know, I think we think about golf in general as to be a safe sport. You're outside, you're walking. Most of us try to play without carts, or some of us try not to play at all. But I think the injury that comes up most when you think about injuries and golf is Tiger Woods and his ACL. So Nirav, what do you think about golf and knee injuries? Is it a safe sport, or is there such a thing as too much golf, too much force across your knee when you're playing golf?
You know, I think in general, I think for most people, golf is a relatively safe sport. It's very controlled. There aren't unpredictable movements. It's obviously non-contact. So I think in general, it's a safe sport, but I think all sports should be done in moderation. If you're going to be swinging too much or placing too much torque, or you don't have the right force, then just like with anything else, if you overuse those knees, you can play strain across it. So whether that be generalized knee pain, whether it be tendonitis, or in cases like Tiger Woods, can you potentially tear your ACL because you're torquing on your knee a lot? So I think in general for the public, it's a great thing to do, but anything in excess and with the wrong form done repetitively can be bad. And you know, with all these athletes now who are getting bigger and stronger and getting more muscular, I worry that kind of the force we're placing on these knees. You see NFL players now who are 300 pounds and running, 4.440s. You know, the ACL is the same size, whether you're 300 pounds, it can bench 700, can bench 700 pounds or squat 700 pounds or not. So I think we're seeing that trend now in golf, where you're seeing athletes are getting bigger and stronger. And I wonder if we are going to see more injuries in the future. You know, Drew, do you see a lot of, in your clinic, because you're dealing with, more adults than myself, are you seeing a lot of traumatic golf injuries from individuals?
I wouldn't say too many of them. I think more commonly I'll see, people with an injury doing something else, and then it's prohibiting them from, getting back to golf, or, they try to swing and their meniscus tear is bothersome and they can't twist like they should, or, have knee pain when they're done playing. Or like you were saying earlier, like those overuse injuries. And I think, most of the time we're not seeing too many injuries like directly from golf, but I think more aggravation from. And I think with Tiger, I think it was that he tore it running, and then he was able to play for a bit even afterwards. And then it was that U.S. Open that his knee finally really gave out on him, but he was able to still push through it to the end. But I think we are seeing like longer drives, and there's definitely like a factor of equipment and improvements in ball technology, club technology. But I mean, like some of these guys, like recently, like Bryson DeChambeau, you've seen him, really put on a lot of weight, a lot of muscle, and is just crushing the ball. And definitely, a lot more force going through the joint than probably we did, 20, 30 years ago, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, we know the ACL is consistent. Like Nirav says, it only holds about 500 pounds of force, and maybe you get a little bit stronger, but it's not going to get a lot stronger. And I wonder at some point we are going to get to a point where golfers are trying to torque their knee hard enough to hit the ball 350, 450 yards. And they're eventually we're going to start seeing ACL injuries with that. I would like to mention, did Tiger Woods, a Stanford graduate, win that US Open?
Sure did.
Yeah. It's a lot to be said about that Stanford education.
Yeah.
What about other injuries, Drew? What other common upper extremity injuries do you see in your practice with golfers, or golfers that are affected by different injuries that keep them from playing?
Yeah, so definitely, you know, elbow injuries, you know, tennis elbow, lateral epicondylitis, just named with tennis, but that can flare up with golf. And then there is golfer's elbow. It's on the medial side of the elbow and just also irritation of the tendons there. And that's just from that like repetitive swing and overuse. And then sometimes we'll even see, you know, hand injuries. Like there's the hammock bone that you can even break if you're, you know, hitting and you hit a tree root or strike the ground too hard, something like that. You can even just have a break there. And, you know, occasionally shoulder pain and mostly like overuse, like rotator cuff tendonitis or you know, just worsening of symptoms from shoulder arthritis, just from that, you know, swinging 100 times over and over again and just kind of wearing out what you have.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think sometimes those are the hardest patients to deal with, the ones with overuse injuries. And Nirav, you've certainly seen this with the peds population where you have something, it hurts when you do it. And even though we don't like to say the answer is to just take a break, sometimes when you have golfer's elbow or tennis elbow, the answer is just take a break, do your exercises, and don't go and grip a club. Nirav, how do you deal with patients or patients' families that just don't want to take a break from their sport?
I know that that's probably the most difficult thing, you know, in my clinic, and I'm sure in a lot of our clinics. I think the way I craft it to a lot of patients and families is by telling them that, you know, if you don't take the break, even though you may be able to push through the pain, you're going to eventually stop enjoying it, and it's going to last for much longer. So I say a little bit of short-term rest will lead to a lot of long-term benefit. I think particularly with golf, because it's one of the few sports that a lot of people are playing right now in COVID, I do worry a lot that people are going to start playing excessively and not want to take a break because it's their one outlet to be out, to be socially distant and get some sort of interaction. So I think all of us as clinicians really need to work on, you know, reemphasizing that you need to take a break. You need to be able to rest these things, and pushing through it isn't good. And I worry then if your elbow's hurting you, your wrist's hurting you, are you changing your swing? Are you playing golf not as well? Or are you then going to hurt something else? So it's both a risk to other areas and also potentially even hurting your golf game. I mean, if you have tendonitis, your handicap's probably going to be higher as well too.
Yeah. So Drew, I honestly don't play any golf, so I don't know the answer to this, but how much do you think having the right equipment for golf plays a factor in some of these upper extremity injuries, especially for the tendonitis?
You know, I think a lot of it is probably like swing related. I think the right equipment will definitely help with hitting the ball, like, you know, distance and control. But I think most of kind of injury risk will probably be driven more like mechanics and, you know, really making sure that your swing is appropriate, not overstressing certain areas. So I think even like with older equipment, newer equipment, probably better to blame the swing than the clubs that you're using.
Not to put you on the spot, but as somebody who plays golf and is interested in biomechanics, how do you improve the biomechanics of your swing? And do you look at videos? Do you think that having a coach is helpful? And do you think that sort of stuff would actually decrease injury rates or repetitive use injuries?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you're trying to improve your swing, like working with a golf instructor has to be the best way to do it. Because so much of it, like you can't really tell just by yourself when you're doing it. A lot of times, like, you know, where you're going wrong. And so, I mean, you'll even see like the tour players have swing coaches. And these are the people that are the best at this, do it all the time. And they still have somebody there giving them feedback on, you know, what to adjust and how to get better. And there's, you know, even better technology now, like there's the TrackMan device that can show you exactly where your swing path is and where your club face is at impact and really, you know, understand what parts of the swing are off to make it a little easier to figure out what to adjust. And, you know, I don't know that there's any clear data to support, you know, like a most efficient swing to limit the risk of injury. And I'll bet a lot of it will depend person to person, how hard you're swinging, like what that swing path looks like. But, you know, I think having a smooth, easy swing is probably best for the game and also probably best for that injury risk too.
Good. Yeah. Speaking of injury risk, Drew, I mean, one of the things we're talking a lot about the overuse injuries, and we touched a little bit on ACLs. We prescribe golf a lot for people who may have arthritis and have undergone, you know, shoulder and knee replacement. But a lot of people will ask questions, when is it safe or when can I go back? I know you've done some research on shoulder replacements. Can you talk a little bit more about kind of shoulder replacements in golf and kind of what you found through that research?
Yeah. And so we have a research study that we've submitted for publication, be published at some point, but we contacted some of our patients after shoulder replacement and who were interested in golf and trying to see, you know, how often people are able to go back to golf and then when exactly they do it and then how successful they are when they go back. So we get a lot of patients who, you know, they have shoulder arthritis, but, you know, golf is a big part of their life and they want to know ahead of time, like, am I going to be able to keep doing this? Am I going to be negatively affected by this? Or is this going to help my golf game? And is this really going to, you know, get me where I want to be? And so with shoulder replacements, there's an anatomic shoulder replacement, reverse shoulder replacement. They're slightly different, used for different reasons. But we found the patients with the anatomic total shoulder had like a, I think it was 92% rate of return to golf. And then the reverse was closer to 65-70%. So still pretty good, but that anatomic shoulder, those patients did seem to do better. And then overall, we found patients getting back, they reported between 3 and 6 months. I'll usually tell people to plan for 6 months at the earliest, but looks like some people are pushing it a bit and getting back a bit earlier. And then overall, like we asked them about driving distance, 7-iron distance, handicap, frequency of play, and handicap didn't change. The driving distance was the same. Their iron distance was the same. So it looked like, you know, for those patients with shoulder arthritis, we could get them back to playing and then about the same level. And then overall, they're feeling better with regards to their shoulder.
So this is starting to sound like Tommy John surgery. Once your golf game starts to suffer, you should just get a shoulder replacement and then you'll be better than ever.
Well, it didn't help with the handicap though. Didn't make the drives longer. So wouldn't, yeah, not quite yet.
I think on the same note as well too, one of the, you know, in the younger population, we see a lot of kids and young adults who, you know, tear their ACL and one of the first things they want to do is get back out to the golf course. And I think there's this conception that, you know, it's not necessarily a cutting or pivoting sport. It's safe. It's low impact. You know, Brian, when do you let your patients who have had ACL surgery go back to golf? Because I think that's seen as an easy way to do something and get out and be active.
Yeah, I think it sort of depends on which leg it is. If it's their trail leg or the one that's behind them rather than their lead leg, I'll be a little bit more conservative. But in general, I usually say that you can start putting around 3 to 4 months. And frankly, I think most people who are avid golfers start even earlier, no matter how much they dislike putting. I tell them they can start doing irons around 5 to 6 months, full drives around 7 months, and then return to full golf around 8 months. And I think, you know, I think that's pretty conservative. You could probably do that a little bit faster. However, I think going through an ACL reconstruction or any major knee surgery, first and foremost, once you've had that surgery, you don't want to do it too quickly and end up doing it again. And I find that a lot of patients, although their initial concern is how can I get back fast, 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 once they've had the surgery, they're much more willing to go through the safe protocol so that they don't have to go through, especially the early rehab protocol again. What about you, Drew? When do you let people go back?
Yeah, usually about the same, like somewhere, you know, around 3 to 4 months for light chipping and putting and then more aggressive swings in that 6 to 7 month range and then full golf around 9 months. And I think the same thing, like I'll err on the side of being a little more cautious. Just, you know, I know myself personally, I have a hard time not swinging hard when I am either at the driving range or playing. So I know I would be very tempted if I were told, oh, you can go hit irons, that I'm going to be hitting them as far as I can and really twisting on the knee. I'll tell people to just take it easy. Like same thing, like just, we don't want to go through this again. Don't want to stretch anything out, re-tear anything. And then usually they don't have like, you know, great control by that point. So, you know, usually can talk them into just waiting a bit and making sure they're safe and returning.
Yeah, I think one thing that's tough is the amount of misinformation or just non-evidence-based information that's out there. And admittedly, there isn't great science on when we should allow people to return to something like golf. But even in a short deep dive of the interwebs, I found that there was information about wearing a brace and that if you wear a brace, you're going to weaken your ligaments and therefore you shouldn't wear a brace longer than 2 weeks. And I found another area that said that golf is totally healthy for meniscus and you cannot tear your meniscus playing golf. And I've definitely seen some golf injuries. So I think it's important to kind of take what you read with a grain of salt and really look at what the evidence is. And the reality is in the end, it's better to be a little bit conservative by a few weeks than be a little bit aggressive, because there really isn't, at least in my mind, there isn't really a medal that gets pinned on the first person back after any of these injuries. What about after a knee replacement? I know, Nirav, your kids probably aren't getting knee replacements, hopefully. But Drew, when do you think it's safe to go back to golf after a knee replacement?
I think in probably like the 3 to 6 month range. I would probably go closer to six. But, again, probably chipping, putting, light irons by three months. And then, working back up to everything by 6 months. And I think, for the knee replacement, you're really looking at quad strength, hip and core strength, and those should be returning around that time frame. What would you tell people?
Yeah, I would agree. I think you could probably start going back as early as 3 months if you were feeling okay. I think the most important thing when you have a hip or knee replacement is getting people back to their normal activities. We know that people that were playing golf prior to a knee replacement are more likely to go back if they've been playing within the first year, within that year. And I think it's really important for everybody's well-being to get them back out doing the things that they wanted to do. So encouraging them, even if it's going to be 9 holes, even if it's going to be the less fancy golf course, I think it's worth at least trying to get them to go out and do as much as they can. And frankly, even the walking part is great exercise. You're going to end up walking 5 to 6 miles. And if you play like I do, 7 to 8 miles. So you might as well try to get people out there, even if they can't do the entire course. And even if you tell them their handicap's going to go up for a little bit.
Yeah. And I think, it's pretty amazing that, we like to think about golf as just this very basic sport, go out and hit the ball and very safe. But as we've clearly shown today, there's a lot of different considerations you have to take into place. And with COVID, not only just the health of people, but, preventing that overuse and really analyzing where we're moving forward with these injuries. Just to conclude, Brian and Drew, if you had to pick one or two things, where do you think the future of sports medicine golf will be? I mean, the bodies are changing a lot. How we train has changed a lot. Where do you think the next big frontier is, Brian and Drew, in terms of golf and sports medicine?
Yeah, I think that having these wearables and eventually even potentially implantable small devices that will be able to give people the competitive edge to beat somebody by one shot by understanding how their body is going to perform well away from the course, I think that's going to be the next big step. Drew?
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, I think especially now with like the swing analysis and all the video that can be used for that, the next thing would be advances in wearables to really understanding what your swing's looking like and figuring out ways to keep that consistent.
And yeah, I echo what both of you say. I think it's the data. It's all the data we're getting and being able to analyze that in real time. And almost like baseball, I think the way we look at the sport's really going to change, where it's very data driven and not as much about feel and touch, kind of like the golfers from 30 to 40 years ago. So it's an exciting time to kind of be at the cutting edge, combining sports medicine and this technology that's out there.
Yeah.
Once again, thank you everyone for joining our podcast again. I want to thank Drew and Brian for contributing a lot of exciting topics to talk about with golf out there right now. And we look forward to seeing you on our next podcast. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the University of California, San Francisco Sports Medicine Podcast featuring Dr. Nirav Bundia, Dr. Brian Feely, and Dr. Drew Lansdowne. We look forward to hearing your feedback and hope you look forward to our next episode. Thank you.